You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hey everyone, it's another episode of Archaeo Animals. Today is episode 3 and we're talking all about dogs. So hi again, everyone. This is Archaeo Animals. I'm your host, Alex Fitzpatrick, and with me as always,
Simona Franga.
And today we are going to hit that age-old question, which is, in fact, who let the dogs out? We'll be doing a step-by-step process trying to navigate who, in fact, let the dogs out, and should be good. Or we're going to be talking about dog bones, probably the latter.
A lot of dog bones and weird dog skulls. But you forgot to mention that we have indeed a guest of honour with us tonight.
Oh, we do have a guest. Our first guest.
Yes, a very important guest because my dog Sandy is sat right next to me. She's more of a quiet observer because she's very quiet, bless her. She doesn't bark.
I can feel the vibe. The vibe is there. So I feel blessed, to be honest.
The good, silent, quiet vibe of Sandy.
Surprising for a dog, from what I know about dogs, to be honest.
Yeah, and I think she's only barked once and she scared herself. So,
that
was her experience with barking.
But let's talk about dead dogs. Dog bones. How do we identify them? What do we do with them? All that kind of stuff and more for today's episode. So, I don't know about you, but I feel like dog bones are pretty, characteristic. I think you could more or less ID them if you find them in an assemblage pretty easily.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Because also, like, they sort of stick out because being used to sort of more farm animals and your sheep and your cow and horse, like, it makes for quite a nice change as well. And you're like, ooh, doggo. It stands out a fair bit.
And we love dogs so much. So, of course, you're going to be so excited to see a dog.
And also because with dog bones, although they're not uncommon, they're not terribly common either.
True.
It's a nice change from the umpteenth sheep.
Yeah, I mean, I think last episode when we talked about domestic animals, it's one of those things you would file under kind of average in a domestic assemblage. But, you know, it's not a sheep, it's not a cow, so it's pretty exciting, to be honest.
It's the 10% of zoo archaeology, because I guess the 90% is solidly on the farm animals.
Yeah.
Of what you get, and then you have the 10% of the pretty and unusual things.
Maybe, yeah, 10% for pretty unusual things, 9% dogs or cats, and then 1% something really out there, for sure.
So yeah, so who did in fact let the dogs out? Long story short, nobody knows.
I wish I could do
it. End of the podcast, end credits.
I wish, oh man, I kind of regret not doing a dog-based PhD project, because I'd love to have just made that the title of, there's not enough dogs in my assemblage to make that my title.
Yeah, just nobody knows. Probably won't know for a while yet.
But the only thing I would say, though, is that dog bones, definitely different from other animals. I think you could, if you looked at a dog bone versus, let's say, cow bone or something, there's enough characteristic differences that it's pretty easy to differentiate between the two. It's a medium-sized animal, things like that. Teeth, definitely, though. I love dog teeth. As someone who doesn't usually like animal teeth, dog teeth are so cool.
Oh, no, I really like dog teeth. And also, I think one that really gives it away is the humerus as well.
Ah, true. Yeah, I wasn't even thinking about that. So I guess, you know, for a way, I know this is a podcast, but let's see if we can describe it to the audience, what a dog humerus looks like. We'll definitely add pictures, but...
So if I remember the terms, more like... I've got some dog skulls and bones hanging out on the desk here to try and sort of visualize them a bit better while I try to describe them.
It's not like I can do any better.
The distal end of the humerus, is that a fossa? What's it called?
Something like that. You're asking the wrong person who, if it was up to me, I would describe everything as something curvy, something straight, something round. But dog humerus...
My favourite thing is that is in metapodials, I just say like the distal end, I just call it the roly bits. So they just like, they're like the roller.
But yeah, I feel like dog bones have a very like curved type of look to them that I think sets them apart in a lot of ways from, say, you know, cervids or sheep or something like that. But definitely the teeth. Dog teeth have this kind of like wave-like shape. Have you noticed that? Like the molars for certain, that they're really cool looking. Yeah. I love them. Like that is, I find that so much nicer than, let's say, the horrible shutter looking teeth that like horse have.
Oh, yeah. One thing that I really like about dogs as well is the incisors.
Ah, yeah, that is true.
Well, because I guess you'll be canids, but I guess they're more prominent in dogs, but so they've got this comb-like shape.
Yeah, yeah.
Sort of scraping meat, unless I'm very much mistaken. So I quite like it. So
yeah, no, it's really nice. And to be honest, like the only thing you can really mix up dogs with is wolves, but we'll get to that later. And foxes, I think, are pretty similar too.
Well, especially because if you get sort of smaller breeds of dog, because that's when identification gets a little tricky.
Yeah.
Because the further ahead in time you go, the more variety you get in dog breeds.
Mm-hmm.
So you can have anything from a big sort of Irish wolfhound type dog to a very tiny sort of lap dog, which could get confused with a fox.
Yeah, definitely. There's a lot of similarities. I find myself occasionally tripping over that. And we'll get more into breeds later because I'm sure we'll need a solid segment of the podcast just to yell about breeds.
And also, that's one of the frequently asked questions as well. So it'll be a good one to discuss later on.
But yeah, also wolves versus dogs. You know, I mean, the slight differences there really make it kind of difficult. Right now, I'm currently kind of fighting between an identification of a specimen I have. Is it a dog? Is it a wolf? It's very close to either or. It's driving me up the wall, to be honest.
It's a new species.
Wolf, dog. Dog,
a mystical
wolf.
Being from another dimension. Mm-hmm.
Well, the problem, of course, is that like whether or not it's a dog or a wolf, it really changes kind of what your assemblage is, because dogs, again, are more associated with domestic sites, things like that. Wolves are more of a wild animal. So it's important to kind of make those distinctions in a lot of ways. Actually, do you know what's funny is what I found recently is what's really close to dogs are seals.
I guess they would be, because don't they call them the dogs of the sea sort of thing?
They really are the dogs of the sea. There's a slight differentiation in, obviously, the actual limbs, because, you know, seals have little flipper type things and dogs don't. But when it comes to the skull and the teeth especially, they're actually really similar. And it kind of surprised me. I couldn't believe how similar they were. Like, it's super cool.
Because I think, is it grey seals that have more dog-like teeth? Because with harbour seals, they have sort of that wavy structure, like in the premolars, but sort of a lot more accentuated. So it literally look like they've got tiny combs that I guess sort of more adapted to a fish diet than a dog will.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, because also they'll be quite important to distinguish between dog and seal. Because, of course, on a coastal site, you're more likely to get seal. But then if you find seal remains in the middle of the Midlands, that gets a little bit more interesting.
It's the first seal to ever live on land fully. But yeah, I mean, again, it kind of just ties into this idea of, like, just having these similar bones. You really need to smack down on, like, what the comp... I went on a weird train of thought that ended up me talking about wrestling, basically. You basically have to really nail down a confirmation of a species, because if you have, let's say, some kind of dog fragment, then maybe seal, then maybe fox, maybe wolf. I mean, those are like four different sites you're talking about right there, for sure.
Well, especially it changes everything. Sort of if you're looking at earlier sort of Paleolithic sites, when it comes down to pinning down who... In fact, they'd let the dogs out, as we discussed previously, because, say, if we have a specimen from, I don't know, 130,000 years ago that was misidentified and wasn't wolf, it was actually dog, that could change a fair amount about what we know about our relationship with dogs.
Oh, yeah, it would change everything. So let's talk more about kind of like dog adjacent things, because, again, I think we're going to need the full segment to talk about dog breeds. You know, one of the other things you associate with dogs is, you know, dog chewing, which I think we talked a little bit about in previous episodes. But dogs have a very unique kind of signature they leave behind if they're gnawing on bones, don't they?
Oh, so like furrow-like impressions on the bone, I find, and also like tooth marks as well.
Not to mention, like, I really like that the slobber ends up making it really shiny. Like, it's disgusting.
Yeah. I haven't noticed that yet myself, although I am just randomly giving Sandy bits of cow ribs and whatnot, so we'll see what she comes up with in a couple of months' time.
Oh, yeah. Let's talk about that, because you're doing a little experimental archaeology with your dog.
More like experimental boredom. More like, it's just...
But still, it ties into what we're talking about. I mean, you know, that's one of the ways that zoo archaeology progresses with experimental archaeology like this. And it helps to know kind of what do these bones look like when they're gnawed up by other animals. So, you know.
And that's not gone, like, undergone, like, 2,000 years of taphonomic processes. To try to just,
I mean, it's still interesting.
Yeah, I don't know. Just try to isolate to the one so you can identify what dog tooth marks would actually look like without all the stuff that probably happened on top of it, sort of in 2,000 years of just being buried underground. But I thought, like, I'm sure there's plenty of material about it and sort of, like, experimental work on dog tooth marks, but I just thought I'd have a little fun. And, you know, Sandy does need entertaining and she loves chewing on things. So we regularly just get presents from one of her best friend, a butcher. She gets a variety of bones to gnaw on for like cow femurs and limbs. So had a good, a fair few ribs and a pig foot, which I have no idea where it's gone to. But she buries them, you see, because sometimes they're a bit too tough for her to chew on. So she'll go and bury them somewhere, wait for them to decompose a little, and then she'll dig them back up and chew on them later.
You know what's weird is I'm thinking about it after you said it, like, I've never really seen a study on, like, the archaeology of the dog burying behaviors. There probably is some that exists, but I mean, I don't know. Something to think about.
No, like, I've never come across anything like that myself, but then unfortunately, as I haven't been in academia for a fair few years now, I don't really have access to most publications, so there'll be a mystery that will be uncovered another time.
I'm too busy to look at it. Let's be real. Just kidding. I'm not busy at all. But but yeah, no, it's actually just something, I guess, realistically, it would be difficult to kind of figure out. I don't know. This is like something I do a lot where I have these grand ideas of why don't someone do an archaeology of blah, 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 and then think about the logistics and go, oh, that's why, because it's hard.
Yeah, but it'll still be like interesting to look at, because if you were to come across, say, a postal that had a couple of bones just stashed in there and looked sort of regular enough but not quite in shape, so I wonder whether it's just a dog burrowing things for later. So that would eventually just make it perturbation.
Dogs are secretly the archaeologist's enemy.
Oh no, nothing beats the badger as the great archaeologist, because the amount of archaeologists, the archaeology and remains that badgers have dug up, like, unintentionally over the years.
Badgers are pretty close to dog skulls, aren't they? Am I misremembering?
Ish. I mean, the teeth can be deceiving as well. Like, if you, at first glance, if you don't really look at it, and if you just find a tooth or, like, or some fragmented parts of the maxilla, you might just like, oh, yeah, dog, and put it to one side. Yeah. And then you look at it sometime later and be like, oh, badger. Because it's just, it doesn't really come to mind, because usually when you deal sort of day-to-day domestic assemblages, you don't really think of coming across a badger.
Mm-hmm.
So your idea, you just see it, you don't even think fox necessarily, you just, you know, you're working on a Roman side, you find like a partial skull, be like, oh, dog, and you don't really give it too much thought until then. Yeah, you have all the haha moments later.
Yeah, it's that bias, I guess, really. I mean, I feel like this might be something we'll talk about in a future episode on, say, exotic animals, but it's hard to shake that kind of, all right, well, it's either going to be a sheep, a cow, a horse, a dog mentality, I feel like, when you first get an assemblage, you know?
Well, exactly. If you find, say, like, horse or, like, equid, like, is that how you pronounce it? Equid remains. You're not necessarily, you're going to think, oh yeah, I found some horse. You're not going to think, oh, what if it's a donkey or a mule? Or even though there is evidence in this country, at least in the Roman period, of donkeys being there and mules as well. Although oddly, the mules didn't seem to have been bred here. They were just imported, if I remember correctly. But we'll get into it in a future episode, I'm sure.
Yeah, we're really bad at jumping the gun, aren't we?
Yes, always.
I'm sure we can make a smash cut of every time we accidentally jump the gun in the wrong episode. I'm sure that would be funny at some point. But yeah, basically, there's more. See, I feel like as we've been talking, I've been realizing more and more how many more animals are pretty similar in osteological composition to dogs, even though I started this episode off by saying dogs are really, you know, distinguishable characteristically. Like,
no, but I think in archaeology, you can end pretty much every sentence with a "but not quite" at the end.
That is true. I think that should be the disclaimer for everything that I personally write. But not quite.
Just like at the end of like every paper, like, oh, like domestication of the dogs finally pinned down, but not quite.
Like, it's a picture of someone shrugging, basically. That's like all of archaeology. If anyone listens to this podcast and they're not archaeologists and want to get into it, if you really want to know what archaeology is like, just think of someone shrugging, like next to a dirt pile, and that's pretty much like accurate for sure.
Yeah, shrug, ritual, but not quite.
And if you want to be a zoo archaeologist, just imagine someone doing the shrug, but they're holding like a sheep skull in one hand and a goat skull in the other. It's basically it.
Sorry, I was just shrugging. I forget this is on a video channel.
Just sitting there shrugging.
Yeah, I was shrugging. The dog is falling asleep. And
all right, I think that does it for this first segment of the podcast. We'll take a little bit break and we'll be back to listen to Simona talk about dog breeds for like a solid 3 hours.
This network is listener supported. We're trying to move away from paid advertising while also creating new shows and supporting the ones we have. The APN has never and will never make a serious profit on our podcast. Every little dime we make goes back into the network and improving show quality. So become a member today at www.archpodnet.com/members to show your support, get some extras, and be a benefactor for archaeological education. Members get stickers, a coffee mug, a t-shirt, bonus content, early access to episodes, a private Slack team to talk to other members and the hosts, and full access to training on Team Black over at arccert.black. So check out our memberships at www.archpodnet.com/members today and support archaeological education. That's www.archpodnet.com/members. Now back to the show.
All right, and welcome back to Archaeo Animals. Today we're talking about dogs for episode 3. So now we're going to just give the mic to Simona. So Simona, how do you feel about dog breeds? And what can we tell about dog breeds based on the skulls?
You're on the spot now. Well, dog breeds are beautiful. I love many dogs. All dogs are beautiful. But I guess, seriously though, I guess one question that I do get quite often is whether we can differentiate between dog breeds and the archaeological record.
Mm-hmm.
And now, in short, the answer is just no. Unfortunately, not. Because, in the past, they would have had a variety of dog breeds, a lot more than you'd actually think. But they would have looked nothing like what they look today, and I might have to start the whole thing again because I'm sort of rumbling all over myself. Yes, there are differences between different dog breeds from a skeletal point of view. Can we necessarily pinpoint a specific breed from samples from the archaeological record? Unfortunately, not yet, or probably just not. Because if you think about it, even breeds that are present today, we would struggle to recognise 100 years ago.
Yeah.
So I've had a little bit of digging.
Like dogs digging.
And archaeology digging.
Oh, I wasn't thinking about that. For a couple of sources.
Now, I've read up a little bit about sort of how dog breeds have changed over time. Like, we're not talking a massive span of time, talking about in the last 100 to 150 years. And you'll have, I don't know, like a prime example is the British Bulldog, which in the 1800s looked quite different than what it does today, because he would have had a relatively long muzzle, which is the exact opposite of what it looks like now. Mm-hmm. And if you are very that keen and not faint of heart, do Google a photo of a British bulldog skull and shrug.
Yeah, they're pretty bad. So I have a couple of pictures that you've asked me to look up. And let's just go through them. So let's talk about bulldogs, first of all. We know you talked about it a little bit, but just looking at a modern bulldog skull right now, where to begin?
Why is it alive?
I know. I mean, that's like...
How is it alive?
That's kind of like the running trend with a lot of these breed skull things is that, oh my God, it's so... we'll put pictures of a lot of these breeds or links to pictures of them in the show notes so you can all, take part of the horror that we are all experiencing right now.
Well, because I think that the issue of what's happening, that's my personal opinion, but in the way, because of course we have selected the breeding of dogs for thousands of years. So, you know, breeds, they're not a thing of today, like because of the dog fancy, like the Romans, the... people in the Iron Age would have had dog breeds. But I think what has changed over time is that we stopped breeding for function and we started breeding for looks, or primarily for looks, because I'm sure like back in the Roman period, they would have also bred for specific looks and what was more pleasing to them. But it's just now, yeah, so like we do have a few sort of working dog lineages, but we're mostly trying to please the public about what they find cute by their beauty standards.
Of course. So...
So now sort of jeopardizing health of the animal in the process, and also that's really what the problem is that there is a market for it. They're made because people buy them. But that's a kind of another...
Well, so back to the bulldog. I'm looking at it. For people who may not want to look at it, which I understand, it's a bit much. It's got a... What is going on with that that mandible, huh?
Yeah, this particular sort of morphology that is found in some dog breeds and cat breeds is called like brachycephalic.
Okay.
So sort of this exaggerated lower jaw and almost like pointing upwards, or like the sort of like you get that when the face is sort of squished up, which could also in some breeds result to a sort of a domed skull. Because you get that in dogs, you get that in cats as well. So like Persian, like some like the Persian or some Oriental breeds have that as well, but then you have the exact opposite in some of the newer Siamese breeds with a very long snout, and I'm sure you get that with some sight hounds, even though I'm not sure how unhealthy that is, in fact, or whether it's just a feature of the animal and it's just happy as Larry.
Yeah, I can definitely see the domed thing in a lot of these pictures of English bulldogs I'm looking at right now. It's I can understand, I wouldn't be surprised if some people found bulldog skulls in the past, like, you know, recent past, and thought they were aliens, to be honest, because they're...
Yes. Oh, another one's a Cavalier King Charles Spaniel.
I have that up as well, and oh my gosh, that is, So again, to describe for anyone who's maybe not brave enough or strong enough morally and spiritually to look at this, it's teeny. Why it's so small though?
Very domed.
It looks like a tennis ball.
A very weird tennis ball.
Yeah, it's very small. I can't imagine. Like it's just like trying to imagine living like that is kind of, it makes me want to never adopt a dog ever again. It's very, and then there's pictures of the spaniel like with, you know, I was gonna say a flesh spaniel. Which is very upsetting, but you know what I mean. It's got all of its bits on. It's not just a skeleton, and it's so cute. But then, yikes! Now you also told me to look up a bull terrier skull, which I have now. The actual hell is that?
Because I think bull terrier is a fairly popular breed. I'm not sure how to describe the way the skull looks now, but like the way that the snout is tilted downwards.
It's weird because it almost looks like, you know, kind of what you would say is the prototypical dog that you would find in archaeological deposits, except for the fact that it tilts like that. You know what I mean? Like, it's almost right.
Yeah, but like if you look at photos of it, like some of bull terriers from say like 150 years ago, the tail sort of disappears. Like, and not only the skull's relatively flat, but it also turned ever so slightly upwards. And in the space of 150 years, it tilted to almost 45 degrees.
Oh my gosh. That is absolutely
why
wild.
That, I do not know.
Yeah.
Ask readers. if anyone knows, please write to us.
I mean, I don't know if I want to know. It'll just make me sad. But yeah, again, for those of you who, you know, aren't looking at a picture, again, you're stronger than I am. I have to look at these things. And it's basically almost there, but it's got I guess what would you call that in actual
but not quite
grown up archaeology words? We're the wrong people to host this new archaeology podcast.
Like approximate zooarchaeology. Well, I guess that'll be the rostrum.
Sure. God, there's going to be real zooarchaeologists who real osteologists who know what they're talking about listening to this, and they're all going to have conniptions. And for that, I'm sorry.
Shrug.
Yeah, exactly. Shrug. That's our new catchphrase is shrug.
Yeah, I'll put that in the avatar as a tagline also. We're
exactly.
Sorry.
But yeah, it's so wild if you look at, you know, the kind of archaeological dog skulls that we find, let's say, here in Britain, and then compare it to the kind of breeding that we have now. It's wild, the changes, and that they all kind of stem from, you know, whatever.
They all descend from the wolf. Yes, even the chihuahua.
Yeah, and my have things changed, honestly. It's a bit wild, for sure. Like, so the other thing you told me to look up, and I have seen this before, but you've made me look at it again, is a pug skull. Now, that's the one that I think everyone should look up. It is, oh God, it's like a culmination of all the other skulls that we've been talking about, for sure.
It's probably one of the worst of the lot. Because it has it all. It's got an incredibly pronounced dome skull.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of brachycephalic trait.
Yeah.
And also, I guess, because the skull is so domed, they don't get much in the way of a sagittal crest either. Because, of course, any dog breed can grow one. But if the skull is sort of too domed, there's really no way for them to grow one properly. Which I guess would mean, like, telling male from female would be a headache. But
headache. We're talking about skulls. Everything's a joke to me. But just to explain to anyone else who may not understand what a sagittal crest is.
The sticky outy thing at the top of the cranium.
I don't mean to put you on the spot. I'm very bad at explaining things too. I feel like it's one of those things where it's like, you know what it is, but if anyone asks you to explain it, you'd be like, it's that thing. And then you'd vaguely point to it.
Essentially that. And also, like, everyone's going to have to bear with me today because I'm pretty sure I've got heat exhaustion and I'm somewhat dying in a corner. I think everyone is. The cat's under the bed dying and the dog's dying on the floor. We're all dying.
Wow, this got morbid fast and we're a podcast about dead things.
Talking about bones.
Oh, God, yeah. Full disclosure, over all of our podcast episodes for a while, we are recording them in the middle of what I'd guess is a heat wave, or the new normal, I guess, where we're all just dying of heat. Speaking of dying, let's go back to dead animals. so yeah, the pug skull is just, it's everything. It's that domed cranium. It's the big upturned thing. The teeth look like my teeth, and I have to go get my teeth fixed in like 2 weeks. Like, it's a bit much.
It's just why?
Yeah, no, exactly.
That's the usual go-to reaction, just why?
And I mean, like, you would know better than I do, like, the kind of, like, health implications these kind of shaped skulls would have.
Well, because I think in the particular case of the pug, they just really have difficulty breathing.
Yeah, they're very
loud. So I've had, like, people that I know that have lost at pugs, they were treated exceptionally well, so there was no fault on the owner's part whatsoever, and they'll have them just randomly stop breathing. Jeez. In the back of the car, and that was that. But then what did they do? They bought themselves another one, and I was just like face palming.
But again, it ties into what you were saying before, in that, you know, the history of dog breeding has kind of moved from more of a functional type of
focus to a more aesthetic focus, which isn't necessarily, you know, good or healthy for the dog.
There's good ways and bad ways of doing it.
Yeah.
Essentially, like, by all means, do breed for looks, but not at the cost of health.
For sure.
And also, I think that if people were more aware of what the health risks were with certain breeds, they probably wouldn't be as prone to go and buy one.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully.
It does bring up an interesting point, though, of like, this is in future archaeologies, this is going to be a point of like, you know, this could be a way for people, future archaeologists, if, you know, the Earth still exists in 1,000 years, and people still exist in 1,000 years, given that we all haven't exploded in heat, that, you know, they might be able to like kind of pinpoint periods of time based on like breeding. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So allow breeds of, yeah, well, because they'll have a lot more things like photographs and things. I'm sure they'll be able to date things based on the emoticons that we used.
True. But like, even removing all that, if you, let's say, you know, like a Y2K situation happens, everyone's internet, like computers and electronics all explode. And we all have to like live without that kind of stuff for the rest of our lives. Like future archaeologists would be able to still see, I feel like, like kind of trends in breeds, like the way we breed dogs, how they look, how it
they would do, and probably just mispronounce things wildly. Sorry, just a flash for like Fallout New Vegas keeps coming in my mind with like Caesar being called Kaiser by anyone else.
Oh yeah, that is true. Yeah, I was actually just talking about that the other day. A bit of a tangent, I guess. Yes, but although in Fallout they do. Dogs still exist in the future, so we have that to look forward to. And they seem to be in the similar breeds that we have.
Oh, and they do have sort of a half cyborg dogs as well.
Yeah, they do have.
Yeah, that one is called Rex. They're sort of half German Shepherd and half sort of bionic weird mess.
Do you ever get jealous of future archaeologists? Because imagine if they get to find like cyborgs, and that would be metal as hell, man. That would be so cool. I want to.
It would be maybe not of our period. I don't think I'd enjoy digging our time period.
Nah, I think about that a lot. I mean, just the future of archaeology, and I feel like maybe this will be a future episode, just like the future of zoo archaeology, because I don't know. I like daydreaming, and I like not thinking about the hellscape we live in right now.
Absolutely.
But yeah, so if anyone out there is really interested and want to, you know, I know I'm tempting everyone with this, but if you find some even weirder looking dog breed skulls, feel free to send it to us on our Twitter at ArchaeoAnimals, because I don't know.
We hate ourselves, so please.
We hate ourselves, and we want to see something awful. So just send us the worst-looking dog skull you can find. Who knows? Maybe we'll do a bonus episode one of these days where we just cry over the horrible dog skulls that we've been sent. I love tempting fate, if you haven't noticed. I just want it to happen. But yeah, if you're brave, definitely look up some of these skulls. Bull terriers, bulldogs, pugs, and what was the other one? The King Charles Spaniel?
Cavalier King Charles Spaniel. You have the King Charles Spaniel and then a Cavalier King Charles Spaniel. They both look a bit odd, but the Cavalier looks odder.
Ooh, I just looked that up. That's awful. I mean, it's not. They're both bad.
Yeah, and I think I don't remember how it went exactly, so feel free to call me on it. But I think it's with a Cavalier, because you had the King Charles Spaniel, and yeah. At one point in time, it was brachycephalic with a short muzzle, but then those were sort of the more sickly animals, so they got bred out, and they had more healthier-looking animals.
Mm-hmm.
And then someone, like people started to complain that it didn't look like the old type anymore, so they went to bred back to that again, and that became the breed standard. And I was like, come on. The breed would be like, oh, I would have normally got rid of those pups. Good, I'll breed some more.
Oh, gosh. There's a lot to answer for with a lot of these skulls that we're looking at. Oh, gosh. Who knows?
In short, just to briefly go back on identifying dog breeds in the archaeological record, because I cut it short to, no, we can't. But the reason why, because... as we mentioned, dog breeds have changed a fair deal over time. And also, even if we find skulls that sort of resemble to present-day breed, really all we can say is like, is sort of deerhound like, say, for example, because morphologically they may indeed look quite similar, but that won't necessarily mean that it is the same breed, because we have no information on the coat color or temperament or tail.
It's close enough.
Close enough. So usually I think in papers, certainly in academic papers, they tend to, if they really have to, just mention, you know, border collie like.
Yeah.
Say, to just help you visualize what sort of dog like it may have looked like-ish, but not quite.
So yeah, hopefully we haven't scared you all off, but we're going to take another break. And when we come back, we'll be talking about some specific case studies about dogs and not about scary dog skulls this time.
But not quite.
Are you tired of the webinars and training offered by the big organizations not being free for members and not really covering what we need? Team Black has the answers. Check out arccert.black/main for our upcoming webinar schedule. All of our webinars happen once a month and seating is limited. Learn everything from field tech basics to drones to digital workflows. We have more classes coming online every month. Classes are always 1 hour and cost just $20. Classes like building a CV and getting a job are always free. That's right. We'll help you get a job, then we'll be here when you want to level up your skills. If you are a professional subscriber to the APN at arcpodnet.com/members, then you get all of Team Black's offerings for free as part of your membership. We have Team Black memberships coming that will give the same for the APN. So $20 a month gets you all the APN swag and extras, plus free training from Team Black. So check out arccert.black for more information and level up your skill set today. That's arccert.black. Hey, podcast fans and digital archaeologists. Have you heard about WildNote? It's a data collection app that works online or offline on your smartphone or tablet, iOS or Android. It allows you to collect field data easily, manage data efficiently, and generate data reports and site records effortlessly. We have a growing list of state site forms built in for your use and some generic forms that will work anywhere. Check out the shovel testing and photograph forms. You can get a free all-access 30-day trial today by going to wildnoteapp.com. That's wildnoteapp.com for your free 30-day trial. Now back to the show.
All right, and we're back with episode 3 of Archaeo Animals, and today we're still talking about dogs. And I guess now we're going to just talk about a couple of specific case studies of dogs. I mean, dogs are, like we said, both common and uncommon, if that makes sense. So there's a couple of, by a couple, I mean a lot of different case studies that you can really look into. Simona, do you want to start off with talking about your Hounds of Britannia?
So yeah, it sounds more interesting than it actually is, but I thought it would be nicer to discuss how, well, specifically sort of in the British archaeological record, because that's sort of what I tend to work with, how you see sort of dog variation changing over time. And of course, the greatest degree of variation is seen in the Roman period, because of course, like during the Iron Age, people still had a fair amount of dogs, but they tend to be sort of more generic in the way they looked morphologically, and they only had sort of very few of different types. But literally when the contacts to the Roman Empire and later with the invasion of Rome, sort of the country exploded with different dog breeds. Of course, as we discussed earlier, we can't really discern breed based on archaeological material. So really, all we've got to go by is, well, the remains themselves, but also the descriptions that we find in the written record. So for example, one interesting publication that sort of uses bits of the of written sources from the Roman period describing hunting dogs in particular, and I think that's just throughout the Roman Empire, not just Britain, is this 1951 publication called Essai sur les chasses romaines. Ooh. And that's sort of quite interesting.
it's fancy because it's not in English.
It's again, it sounds more interesting than no, it is a very it is an interesting publication of dogs with ancient or long dead dogs are your jam. So, of course, yeah, you can look at the written record of publications that collate to the written record, and also artistic representation of dogs, say for like statues and mosaics. And of course, you don't get many of those in Britain per se. I mean, there's like one place, like the place for dog bronze statues, and that's the Temple of Nodens in Gloucestershire. Mm-hmm. That's a 4th century temple that like a plethora of sort of dog bronze figurines have come out of it. Yeah. And so, like, we'll probably get into it a bit later on a different episode when we talk about ritual a little bit more, but that's been interpreted with the statues being ritual offerings from the pilgrims.
Oh, okay.
For the whole thing that dogs sort of are associated as agents of healing during that time period.
Mm-hmm.
Never mind that, tangent off. back to Roman doggers. When the Romans sort of settled in Britain, so yeah, we got a much wider variety of breeds. And actually, like according to several sort of sources from the time period, one of Britain's main export was actually dogs, and yeah, British hounds being very highly priced.
Mm-hmm.
So among like still looking at the written record, one of these sort of very like highly priced dogs was a breed called the Agassiz,
mm-hmm.
however that's meant to be pronounced, which was a very lean, rougher breed. That it was indeed quite small, sort of, and lean, but also very strong and swift. Then they would have the Scottish Chicanis, which is sort of like an Irish hound, Irish wolfhound like dog. And you would have had Molossians or Molossian type breeds that make an appearance as guard dogs. So, also, so you'd have had your hunting dogs that would have hunted anything from a hare to deer and wild boar. You'd have your guard dogs that became quite popular in the Roman period just for like home guarding.
Mm-hmm.
Your herding dogs that were, of course, like very popular and widespread because they would have played a vital role on the farm, on the farmstead.
Yeah.
They would have guarded the flock from thieves, because predators and all sorts of things. And yeah. Lots and lots of different types of dogs, and you see them in the remains. And of course, they would have been mostly sort of practical in their morphology because they all had a job to do, with the exception of pet dogs that also really made an appearance from the start of the Roman period.
Because
people started importing pet dogs, lap dogs that will just sit and most likely yap around. So they were there as well, and you find them sort of extensively reproduced sort of in more artistic representations as well, as you do with sort of some of the hunting dogs as well, because the sort of Irish wolfhound-like dogs that I was describing earlier are found a fair amount on sort of hunting cups.
Oh, okay.
But they usually, this type of sort of ware was popular in the 2nd century, and it was usually sort of was decorated in the barbotine or barbotine, again, however you pronounce it.
Someone will tell us in the comments.
Technique. Yes, please tell me how to pronounce stuff in the comments. Essentially, with barbotine, it's a thick clay slip that gets molded onto the pot surface to get the sort of this relief decoration. And you have this hunting cups, and they usually got a black slip in colour, and they've got, well, as the name says, hunting scenes, and they quite frequently feature these type of sort of very lean and large hunting dogs, usually hunting either a hare or a deer. And you find them sort of all over the country and all over sort of the northwestern provinces of Rome, really. But long story short, yes, hounds of Britannia, plentiful and varied.
Another case study kind of to... to just springboard off of that. Usually on this podcast, we try to bring up case studies that are easily accessible to our audience, whether they're academics or non-academics. But in this case, I do want to just talk about Adrian Chadwick's work, which his article can be found in a book called The Materiality of Magic, which is a really great edited volume. If you can get your hands on that, I'll put all the information down in the show notes. But basically, the paper kind of talks about the connections that dog remains have with ritual, which is kind of what you were talking about as well. And how there's this kind of phenomenon of finding the dog remains in Romano-British wells.
and how that, you know, there's this idea that it might be linked to Cerberus, the three-headed dog, and Guardian of the Underworld and things like that. Dogs being found in kind of liminal spaces, like in ditches or doorways. And again, I will put the information in the show notes if you want to read about that. But again, just another kind of additional note to what you're talking about, in that, you know, dogs are kind of associated with this kind of ritual kind of idea that ends up correlating into, you know, being immortalized in art and kind of treated differently after death, things like that.
Oh, absolutely, especially if you look sort of at special animal deposits, so like sort of animal deposits other than just your usual run-of-the-mill food waste, dogs tend to feature a lot more prominently. So in a way, like, dogs are not very common in the archaeological record overall, but percentage-wise, if you look at special animal deposits, then dogs are incredibly prominent.
Yes, definitely. And again, we will have a whole episode, or maybe two, depending on how much we have to say, there might be a lot, about ritual, because there's a lot you can say about animal ritual, and there's definitely a lot that I and you can say, you and I. Oh my gosh, this is why I'm not an English major. another article that I found while perusing that will also be in the show notes if you'd like to take a gander. I don't know if you saw this, Simona. It was kind of recent, a couple months ago. There was this whole big thing of from the Mesoamerican archaeology side of things, where they uncovered what seemed to be quote-unquote Mayan rituals, and how dogs and cats may have been either venerated or sacrificed or something like that.
Oh yeah, was it the one with a chihuahua-like dogs, so sort of like, and not just like cats, but actual big cats and
gangers so.
That seem to have just been kept there?
Yeah, I'm trying to
either venerate.
I'm trying to look at the article again, and I've apparently reached my article limit on The Economist, so that's helpful. I hate paywalls.
It's such a thing, you know.
I don't even look at The Economist. Anyway. Yeah. So again, there's this, you know, dogs seem to be almost ubiquitously linked to ritual. And I wonder if that has to do with the fact that, you know, humans and dogs have always had this kind of bond that makes them, you know, almost elevated in terms of how we see them. Maybe not as animals, maybe something between animals and personhood. It's a lot to talk about, I guess.
Oh, definitely. I think the bond got a lot closer as time went on.
Basically, it seems like every, I don't know, 6 months, there's a new new research out making the domestication point of dogs even older than we thought. We'll put this in the show notes as well. Kind of more recent, again, this year, research that came out in National Geographic about 14,000-year-old canine that shows that prehistoric people may have cared for a sick puppy. So that kind of idea of emotional attachment equals bonding and things like that.
I think it's, like, it's always been a case that humans have always loved cute, fluffy things.
Yeah, you know.
I think I remember a site. It was a prehistoric site in North America. Now, I can't quite remember where it was, mm-hmm. but they found sort of a wild felid, I forget which species, sort of associated with a settlement, and it sort of shows it died quite young, so but it did show that, like, someone took it in and probably looked after it.
Uh-huh.
And now they're presuming a child. I can't quite recall why they made that argument. But it's just, yes, see cute lynx, take it home.
I mean, I don't blame them.
That's probably why a lot of domestication started. Oh, they look cute.
It's truly the ubiquitous thing of throughout time is it looks cute. So, you know, gotta pick it up.
Looks really like we've changed so much and also not an awful lot at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's funny, like, how much that kind of bond really ends up in our interpretations of, like, archaeological research. Like, I think this was from an academic paper I read a while ago, but there was this whole thing about dog burials and how the dog burials in a site in Siberia, I think it was, they were buried closer in form to, let's say, human burial rather than how animal remains were normally discarded.
But then, of course, one difficult thing that you need to do when interpreting, especially sort of dog remains or species that are closer to us, or at least sort of in the West, is sort of, yeah, taking away the bias, is sort of like not interpret the relationship between past people and said species the same way as we would now. Because even though dogs were very important members of the community back in antiquity, say in Britain, people also did not shy away from eating them if they needed to.
Of course, yeah, and that's actually a really good point to bring up is, you know, the kind of bias. I mean, this goes for zoo archaeology and archaeology in general, but, you know, there is this kind of thing we need to always keep in mind, which is that the perceptions between, like, modern-day perceptions versus, let's say, prehistoric perceptions are going to be different. So there might be a shared kind of perception of dogs being, you know, man's best friend, as people like to say. But like you said, you know, people would eat dogs. It's
but it comes to a point where, you know, if you gotta eat, you gotta eat.
I mean, yeah, exactly. I mean, and it is an important bias to kind of confront.
Because it's something I find that people struggle to accept sometimes. And the thought, like, oh, no, we couldn't have possibly eaten dog. No, yes,
yeah,
we did.
No, exactly.
An amount, a bunch.
Yeah, exactly. You know, maybe it's because I've been doing archaeology for a fair amount of time and been exposed to kind of what I would necessarily not, I don't want to say taboo, but not necessarily something I would think of doing as someone with modern sensibilities. But, you know, it's getting over that kind of, like, you know, shock. Not really shocked, because that makes it seems, I don't know, that seems a bit out of line.
It's sort of like, in a way, like you've got to, like, erase sort of your cultural bias, yes, when you look at the archaeological record, because just because, I don't know, say you're British and you're working on a British site from 2,000 years ago, the people might have thought, like, in a radically different way from you.
Yeah, exactly.
Actually, no, just cut that whole thought out, because I don't even know where I'm getting
at. No, I think it totally makes total sense. And I think dogs are a really good way to talk about this, because I think it's a general concept in archaeology, whether you're dealing with, you know, how people dealt with human remains versus how, you know, people saw different animals. It's completely different in a lot of cases.
I think, like, a big one as well that people usually struggle to come to terms with is ritual cannibalism.
Yeah, that's the one I was actually thinking of. And to be fair, like, people eating dog is kind of similar in that, you know, you elevate this animal to what I would say is about the same level as a person. You would love a dog as much as you love a person. So the idea of eating a dog is kind of, you know, a little out there for you. But
because, well, I guess depending on the culture you're from, you almost have, like, different classes of animals. So you've got your class A, which are the ones that are considered pets,
mm-hmm,
that you'd find taboo, and you'll just, like, would not be able to accept the fact, like would never eat them, and others are sort of fine to eat.
Yeah.
And even, sort of, say, within Western Europe, you see differences in what animals are eaten and what aren't. So, example, I think here in Britain, there was a big scandal a few years back, because I think they found out that
it was a horse,
sort of,
right?
Burgers, it was horse.
Yeah.
And people were outraged because people really love a horse in this country. So, of course, like, equestrianism is a lot more developed here. A lot of people keep horses.
Mm-hmm.
Now, where I'm from, horse meat is a delicacy and costs,
okay,
a fair amount of money.
Yeah.
So if that happened back home, people have gone, ooh, yay, get a horse for cheaper.
Yeah, it's just, you know, it's just differences in culture. And I mean, realistically, if we were all more accepting, we wouldn't be in the hellscape that we live in now. Anyway, I think that about does it for this episode. What a strangely political way to end off. But hey, you know, it's what we're here for.
We're sorry.
Nah, I'm not. Go eat a dog if you want. I don't. I'm okay with it. But yeah. So
don't say that in front of Sandy.
Oh, sorry. I love
you,
Sandy.
You upset her now.
But yeah, I guess that'll do us for this episode of Archaeo Animals. As always, you can find us on Twitter at Archaeo Animals. You can find us on Facebook. We have a page for our podcast there as well. Send us any questions you have. We will eventually get to them at some point in the future, whenever. Some point we will, I promise. But in any case, we will see you next episode. So
yeah, thanks for listening. And Sandy's waving her paw.
I'm shrugging, as always.
but not quite. Talking about starter, ain't nothing I can take a set starter. Leave his belly, leave his big a set starter. Ain't nothing I can take a set starter. Thank you for listening to Archaeo Animals. Please subscribe and rate the podcast wherever you get your podcast from. You can find us on Twitter at Archaeo Animals. Also, the views expressed on the podcast are those of ourselves, the hosts and guests, and do not necessarily represent those of our institution, employers and the Archaeology Podcast Network. Thanks for listening.
This show is produced and recorded by the Archaeology Podcast Network, Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle, in Reno, Nevada, at the Reno Collective.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.